Turning now to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2 and verse 7. Nehemiah, chapter 2, verse 7. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. And our subject is precautions for recovery, that is, recovery from a time of severe spiritual decline. We began last study to look at the book of Nehemiah in order to see the great lessons that are set before us for this theme, recovering from decline. Now, I won't recapitulate at all the initial verses and stages, but here in verse 7 of chapter 2 is the formal request of Nehemiah to the king, to Artaxerxes, the emperor of Persia, the Persian Empire, and he asks for authority to go and to administer affairs in Judah and to rebuild particularly the wall of Jerusalem. And that authority is given. And it's given by letter with escort troops, and Nehemiah is to be the governor of Judah, that seemed at that time to have no governor. Things were in a sorry state. We did see that Nehemiah was made aware of the full depths of the state of the Jewish people in Judah, and particularly the state of Jerusalem, by a person who is described as a brother, Hanani, possibly literally a brother, within Nehemiah's family, possibly a near kinsman relation. But Hanani, although the passage doesn't say so, might appear to have brought some considerable data and information so that some plan could be evolved for the repair of the wall of Jerusalem that was largely broken down. Because Nehemiah would appear to go with a great deal already planned, because he got down to work once he arrived in Jerusalem so rapidly, and his survey was so brief and yet very accurate, yet so it would appear that Hanani or others had brought considerable information about what exactly needed to be done, what materials were necessary, and so on. In fact, the Jewish historian Josephus seems to think that it took 5 years, this period of preparation between Nehemiah's request to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and his actual departure. More likely, your natural expectation from reading the passage would cut the time down to, who knows, 3 months, 6 months of preparation, but doesn't seem to hint at any long period of time. And Josephus, we know, was wrong on many things and probably was wrong on this, something that took place long before his own lifetime. But anyway, there would have been a little period, I'm sure, before Nehemiah actually left. And there's a detail given to us in verse 8, but I'm going to hurry through these verses. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace and for various other buildings to strengthen the wall and significant places. So Nehemiah had authority, the passage tells us, to give him a safe journey through the different regions that lay between Susa, the capital of Persia, the centre of the empire, and Judah and Jerusalem. And the journey would have taken him something between 3 and 4 months, it can be calculated from the information given to us within this book. But he had to pass through different authorities. He was given soldiers, an escort, a guard. Don't feel that this makes Nehemiah any less spiritual than Ezra, who preceded him some years before and who spurned any royal bodyguard, anything of that sort. Ezra was a priest and he went on a religious mission. But now Nehemiah is going as the governor of Judah, appointed by the emperor, and his is a political mission, and so it's appropriate for him to travel with the full regalia and escort and so on. And so, verse 9, then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. And this probably includes the various governors along the route and then down into Samaria, Sanballat, and Tobiah and others who are going to be mentioned, and we'll describe them as we go on. In verse 10, Sanballat, the Horonite, Horon is in Moab, so the governor of Samaria, that's Sanballat, and he is a Moabite. And Tobiah, the servant, and the description, the servant, no doubt means servant of the Persian state, or official, government official, because that's what he was. Don't think that he is Sanballat's servant. Tobiah, no, is another governor in all probability. And the Ammonite. But it grieved these two and others also exceedingly. They were very angry, furious, that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. And that's significant information, because Tobiah, who governs or seems to have governed the region east of Jordan, it's a catastrophe for Sanballat and for Tobiah, because they were obviously trying to wipe out these Jews who had come back into the region, or turn them into slaves, make them just an annexed vassal area. That was their plan. They had impoverished them and turned them into workers and producers for themselves, and they were furious that there was going to be some re-establishment in their eyes of Judah, and someone had come from the Persian court, a Jew, no less, to establish this and to achieve this. But the information begins to tumble out of this chapter, which helps us to see the real situation. Verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Now, I think it's right to see in this that he had no great reception. You might think that those, the heads of the families in Jerusalem, that the Jewish elders and the priests that were there and others would be very excited to have a Jewish man appointed by the emperor to come as governor of their city and their region and to administer affairs. You might think this would excite them no end, but it doesn't appear to have done. The reception was flat. I don't think we read too much into this. He's there 3 days and nothing happens. There is no excitement. There is no reception. There are no festivities. And how do we account for this? Well, it's because the people in Jerusalem were in such despair. They were heavily oppressed. It had been going on a long time, and they'd given up hope. So somebody comes from the court of the emperor and a Jew, and they cannot believe that anything like that will make any difference at all. So there's this flat reception. And I think you find that today. In this period of severe spiritual decline that we have in our land, I think you find exactly the same thing, a kind of despair among the more conservative and reformed evangelicals who stand for the truth. I'm not talking about the wild optimism of the charismatics and so on, with all their shallowness and their gimmicks and their efforts. I'm talking about serious biblical Christians, nevertheless, seem to be in so often in a state of despair. They don't seem to think anything will reverse the process of decline. They cannot get particularly concerned or excited about anything. You hear talk of prayer for revival, but I wonder whether God is at all impressed by prayer for revival, whether it's really prayed with any faith. Actions speak louder than words. And just as there was a flat reception for Nehemiah, there's a flat tone in the ear of God to prayers for revival. Because people pray, Lord, send revival. Do this, do that. But if you say to them, start a Sunday school in your church. Pastor, start preaching some distinctively evangelistic sermons calculated to stir souls and bring people into the kingdom. People get down to work. This is so in many churches. Get down to work, visit the community, do this, do that. There seems to be general despair. Nothing will work. We'll spend the next 10 years thinking about it. We won't stir ourselves. We cannot imagine there can any good come out of these things or any blessing. And that surely steals from prayer for revival any faith, any genuineness. Why, God is going to say, you ask me for revival, but you don't think I can do or will do anything. You won't get down to anything in the meantime. You won't work. No amount of exhortation seems to persuade you. And there are many, many churches in our land, sound churches with good people in them, Reformed and evangelical churches that are in this state and condition. And I think it corresponds very closely to Jerusalem of those days. Something beyond all our dreams has happened. A Jewish dignitary has come from Shushan the palace, from Susa, from the emperor, to be governor here and to rebuild the walls. So what? Nothing can change our situation. Nothing can happen here. And we've got to try to pray people and shake people out of this kind of despair, this sense of hopelessness or failure to trust in anything that can be done for the Lord of glory. Well, let me come to verse 12. I arose in the night, and I and some few men with me, neither told I any man of what my God had put in my heart. None of the leaders, none of the priests, none of the leading Jews or elders in Jerusalem. He was going to carry out his survey without them knowing anything. And there's surely a reason for this. Nehemiah knew that decline, and we were stressing this last study, is our fault. And remember I was saying, spiritual decline, it isn't Darwin's fault. It isn't the fault of society. It's the fault of the church. That's what we learned from Nehemiah last week. As soon as he heard the news, Jerusalem is in this shocking, shocking condition, he confesses the sins of the nation. He doesn't blame the people in Samaria or the people on the east side of Jordan, or any of their enemies, or the Ashdodites, the Ammonites. He blames the Jews. And of course that was right. That's what the scripture repeatedly tells us, that they bring these periods of decline upon themselves. The promise of God is always there, that if they were faithful and zealous, God would use them and bless them. And it's the same. We've got to try to appeal to people to get this out of their system, that when there is decline, it's never our fault. We're the victims. We're the sufferers. Well, we know that even in the sovereignty of God, the rate of blessing ebbs and flows, but we should never be as low as we are today if it were not for serious faults in even sound churches. And we have to look for them, and we have to repent of them. And here Nehemiah knows that the decline within Jerusalem will be due to the fact that there are among the people many people who cannot be trusted. And if he trumpets his purpose and makes it plain what he's come for, as sure as anything, there will be obstruction to him. When he carries out his survey, there will be attacks upon him. He could be attempts at assassination. And so it turned out to be true. He found, as time went on, there were many turncoats, compromisers, people who were more for the enemy than they were for their own side among the people. There are always problem people in times of decline. That's why there is decline. Because people have been let into the churches who shouldn't be there. people have been appointed as office bearers and pastors who should never have been. They never had faith and conviction and real dedication to the Lord. There are people who are really worldlings at heart. And how you see it today, one of the amazing things about the internet is you can see a side of certain people you never saw before. All these ministers who have quit Twitter accounts. And if you should have the misfortune to see they're all open and public, some of their remarks, they speak just like worldlings to each other. They join in the Twitter culture. They speak like thugs sometimes. They say terrible things. They did jettison all refinement, all spiritual bearing. And you're shocked. You say to yourself, I never realized there were so many worldlings in the ministry. So many ministers sharing their taste in worldly things and so on. That was never so public as it now is. And you see what happens in decline. And Nehemiah knows this, so he keeps quiet about his purpose until his survey is completed. I'm afraid I'm going to have to go rather faster, but you get this wonderful account, beginning there in verse 13, of how he went. And in verse 12 he tells us he had no beast with him except the one he rode upon. In other words, no gathering of horses or anything that would make a noise. This survey must be carried out in dead silence. Presumably he had a silent ass, and that's about all to ride on. And he went on this great circular tour. And there follows in these verses a marvelous description of the perimeter of Jerusalem as it was at that time. And we won't go through it, but it's worthy of study, even at a technical level by itself, because there's no other source as rich as this about the layout of Jerusalem in those days. Well, then he was ready. He did his survey. It could be done swiftly, because as I suggested earlier, he had a great deal of the information. He possibly had drawings and a plan of what parts were broken down, what parts remained, where the best heaps of whole stone rubble was, and all the rest of it, where the dust and debris was that could scarcely be used again. And he did a thorough survey. And then he was ready to speak to the people. And in verse 17, he appeals to them. You see the distress we are in. He speaks with authority. How Jerusalem lieth waste. He's a newcomer, but now it's out. He's seen it. He's examined it. When no one was around, when there was no obstruction, by moonlight, he's covered every inch of the perimeter. The gates thereof are burned with fire, and he appeals. This is probably a long speech compressed into a couple of verses. Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. A spiritual reason is given. For the sake of the honour of God, we, his people, should no longer be such failures in such poverty and subject to constant raids by the people around us. And verse 18, then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me. He doesn't just tell them he's got authority from the emperor of Persia. He tells them exactly how it came about and how God heard his prayer and the different evidences of God's direct intervention. And they, or most of them at any rate, are convinced. And he stirred their spirit and carried them with him, so that they said, let us rise up and build. And they prepared themselves. They strengthened their hands for this good work. It doesn't tell us how, but possibly he persuaded the priests to speak regularly to the people and remind them of their heritage. They were to be prepared in spiritually and in morale. And of course, they would have to train people to fight. They hadn't done anything with arms for a long time. And so preparation was made. Verse 19, but when Sanballat, the Horonite, governor of Samaria, and Tobiah, the official, the Ammonite, and Geshem, the Arabian, heard it, another governor. They laughed us to scorn and despised us. So scorn was their response. They had succeeded in bringing the Jewish population of Jerusalem into such poverty and such despair. They couldn't believe that a man with a few servants from Susa could reverse this whole process of decline. And so they laughed. What is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? In other words, this group of governors, this is going to be their political approach. They're going to begin to start feeding information back to Artaxerxes and his officials that the Jews are bent on rebellion and independence. That's going to be one of their methods. But we suffer the same type of thing today. They laughed us to scorn. I think things are so bad that atheists and liberal theologians, people now who've got seem to command all the authority and hold sway, the gay lobby, the whole lot of them, if they even notice or know about evangelical Christians and reformed conservative evangelical Christians, and they heard that we were set about winning souls once again and churches were reviving, they would say, you can't do anything in this land. We control it now. We've even got the law on our side. You can't topple this crusade, the crusade for secularism and atheism and unbelief. You can't change this current. It's gone too far. We've got practically all the people in the land now answering opinion polls and saying they approve of our new morality, our alternative to Christian morality. And they want these various liberalizing laws to be passed. What can you do? These feeble, feeble Christians. We'd have exactly the same attitude. We have disgracefully allowed our cause to sink so low. And this is the model which we have in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 19 or verse 20. Then answered I them. This statement by Sanballat and Tobiah in verse 19 probably was in writing. They probably put this to officially even to Nehemiah, because the language of verse 20 is rather official. Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. He doesn't say, first of all, I have a warrant from King Artaxerxes. He says, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. As though he's putting down some kind of a marker and saying, you wait. You see what unfolds in the future. We're working under the promises of the God of heaven. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. And then this statement, but ye have no portion, which many suggest means something like this. You can keep out of our affairs because you have no legal jurisdiction in Judah or in Jerusalem. And that was true, of course. Judah and Jerusalem now had an official governor. Was none of their business. Governors they may be of adjacent regions, but they had no right to set foot without permission in Judah or Jerusalem. The language seems to suggest that. Ye have no portion, but anyway you have no place, and you have no rights, and you have no memorial, no future in Jerusalem. Well, it's a robust statement, but we must learn from that. This is why we believe, well, not just for this reason, it's to all the prophecies of the Bible, and it's in the New Testament, but we believe that the New Testament church, individual churches, are churches with a regenerate membership. We welcome all people into the congregation, but we believe that the membership of the church is for regenerate believers. Unbelievers have no part, no portion, no right, no memorial in Zion. That's why we say the Church of England, a national church like that, is really not fully reformed, even if there are some reformed men in it. We say the church as an organisation is not properly reformed. It consists of everybody in the parish, all kinds of the majority of technically proper members of the Church of England, the majority of them are not saved. The majority of them never attend. But they are on the electoral roll in many a parish, and they belong. People who the Bible says have no right, no portion, no place in that. Anyway, I pass on and I come to this third chapter. And I'm not going to go through all of this because it's a chapter of wonderful names, but I can comment on it briefly. Then Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brethren, the priests, and they builded the sheep gate. That's where they began. The sheep gate where the sheep came into the city from the countryside around that were being brought for sacrifice, for slaughter, for worship purposes. And Eliashib the high priest and his party, the priests, began to rebuild the wall. And then in verse 2, you read of the men of Jericho. So people were travelling from fair distances, from around, to come and join in the building of the wall. And you see more about that a little later on. And then there is the long list of all the families and the people who built. And the beams are mentioned in verse 3, which refers, I suppose, to roof beams. In verse 5, there's an interesting reference to the Tekoites. They repaired, but their nobles put not their necks to the work of their Lord. Their elders, their noblemen, they didn't lift a finger. And in chapter 6 and verse 17, you get an explanation for that. Moreover, in those days, this is much later on, the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and they were turncoats. Some of the rich men, some of the wealthy men, were sold out to the enemy, to the surrounding nations. And so you get an explanation as to why they had no enthusiasm to join in the work. Same in the churches of Christ. If we have a project and it involves all fit and able people, and people come into the whole crusade or project and play some part in it, and some people who are able-bodied and could be involved are not involved, there's usually an explanation. They're in some state of compromise or disobedience spiritually in their lives. And you see it here, just looking at the details in this chapter. But again, if I go to verse 22 of chapter 3, and then you note, after him repaired the priests, the men of the plain, more priests, Levites are mentioned too. Tremendous organisation. Everybody is involved who's willing to be involved. Great care has been taken. Nehemiah was a great organiser, all the people who worked with him. There's no overlap. Certain people, families, are apportioned to different parts of the wall. There appear to be no quarrels. The professionals, the middle classes in the city are involved. The passage even mentions, though not in our translation, the perfumers. Certainly mentions in verse 32 the goldsmiths. And it's some of the people with lily-white hands who were engaged in professional activities are actually named in the passage as doing double stints, doing one project and then going on to do another. So everybody was equal in this great endeavour to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. There's some very interesting and puzzling touches that people draw attention to. Down in verse 30, there is reference to Hanan, the sixth son of Zalaph. The sixth son. Interesting how some of the old writers would pause and give long and elaborate possible explanations as to why the first five sons were nowhere to be seen. And whole sermons have been preached on the first five sons. And we don't even know if they were alive. And we don't know their names. But it is very tempting, isn't it? Five bad sons and one good one on the end is involved in the work. And a preacher can get to suggesting all sorts of reasons why that might be. But I won't attempt that this evening. I go on to chapter 4 because time is racing on. But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. Now, this isn't mockery like the first time. He mocked and scorned the Jews the first time because he really didn't think they would accomplish anything. It was like this for you when you were converted. It was certainly like this for me. How many people told you you'd get over it? How many people told you you'd soon change your mind, it wouldn't last, you'd grow out of it, especially if you were a young person. You'd soon forget all about it and change, but you didn't. Now Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, they began with scorn because they really thought, these Jews, they have no living God as they claim, they have no divine help. We'll discount that straight away. What can they do? That wall is smashed to bits. And we have complete control over these people. How can they reverse that? But now the wall has started and it's going up. And they have to choke back this derision. The unexpected has taken place. Progress is being made. So now the mockery is not like the first mockery. Now it's a weapon. Mockery sometimes is because people really don't think you'll ever make it. But then, when they realize you are accomplishing something, it's like a spear, or a bow, or a sword. It's designed not to express their lack of belief in the possibility that you'll succeed, but it's designed to depress you and dissuade you and demoralize you. So there's a great campaign of demoralization begins. That's the devil's work. Demoralizes us if he can, undermines faith, and so on. Well, verse 2, he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria. He's now standing by the military. And said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? And Tobiah, the Ammonite, he's still very doubtful and scorns if they're building, it won't stand, it won't last. But the response of Nehemiah is to pray. You might think it's a vindictive prayer. I don't think it is a vindictive prayer. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity. This prayer is not the kind of prayer we should pray, but Nehemiah has either himself, or through the priests, the high priest, or some competent person, been given a clear view of the motives of Sanballat and Tobiah. And he knows they are unrepentant, unwinnable, unmovable enemies of the Lord. So it's a kind of prophetic prayer in a way. It's a prayer prayed with the advantage of information that these people have sinned against the Holy Spirit and they're going to defy and attack right to the end. So we don't have that kind of insight into anybody. We dare not pray, Lord, judge them tomorrow. Put them into a state of catastrophe and fear. It would be vindictive for us to pray, but not, I believe, for Nehemiah, because he had insight or information through the priests of the condition of these people. Verse 5, cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger. before the builders. His reason isn't for what they're doing against us, but because they've provoked the Lord. Verse 6, so built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof. Our translators would appear to think, and they're possibly right, that this means that finally the brickwork or the reconstruction was linked all the way round up to half its height. The Hebrew actually is quite ambiguous, and it could mean the wall was partially built in some other way, only half built in its perimeter. But our translation suggests that the translators take it to mean it's joined hand, as it were, around the entire circle, but it's only half up constructed. For the people had a mind to work. But this is significant, because when that wall is half built, in a way, it turns out they're home and dry. Because the big attempts of Sanballat and Tobiah and the other governors to attack and to stop the work fails. It can't be done. And I'll tell you why it can't be done. You see, they can't go to full war. If those other governors mounted a full-scale war, they'd have the Persian overlord down on them like a ton of bricks. In using military force at all, they've got to do it carefully. They've got to do it by some kind of insurgency. They've got to engage in guerrilla warfare and things that can be covered up and lied about, things that are not going to have them under discipline or deposed for breach of the peace in the Persian Empire. And by the time the people had got that wall halfway, that enemy, who was restrained to some extent by Persian law, really had lost his power to strike them seriously at all. And it's the same with us. The devil is powerful, but he is under the restraints of the Lord. If only churches and Christian people would become active again, and the blessing would begin, then a lot of the venom of Satan would be held back by the power of God. If only they would get started. So often we can't persuade people even to begin. I was being told by Brother Cooper, even of another incident just recently, of a pastor who tried to persuade quite a number of churches to take an interest in a Sunday school conference. And you know, the only replies that pastor got were for former tabernacle pastors, tabernacle people. And none of the other churches in the area were the slightest bit interested in such a thing. I spoke to a pastor in a school of theology. He sat on the front seat. I know who he is. I spoke to him and talked to him very nicely, very politely. And he just complacently, I spoke about Sunday schools. I didn't know he didn't have a Sunday school. I wasn't getting at him. But he immediately said, oh, yes, we've thought about having a Sunday school for some years, actually. But his whole demeanour and his tone showed no interest, no urgency. We've thought about it. Very indifferent and complacent and lazy. What a tragedy. If people would only get started in the work of the Lord, they'd prove the Lord and they'd be safe and underway. Just like the Jews of old, halfway or safe. They broke the back of the hostility when they were only half built. That's a very remarkable fact. Well, verse 7, it came to pass when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, they're completely encircled by enemy governors in that list. Everyone around them was against them. When they heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up, and they're only halfway, and that the breaches began to be stopped, they weren't finished stopping them up, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. It isn't only the army of Samaria, it's all the others now. And again, the typical response of Nehemiah, verse 9, nevertheless we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. and the following verses describe it. What a sad verse is verse 10 of chapter 4. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build the wall. Now the old writers, I think, are absolutely right when they interpret this verse in this way. They say Judah was looking for an excuse to stop. They were scared of the amassing enemy forces. They were scared of attack. And Judah, of all tribes, began to produce plausible arguments to stop the building of the wall. It doesn't seem that Nehemiah treated these arguments with any respect at all. They're just mentioned and passed by. But that's what that verse is doing there. I'm sure there are people afraid to carry on. But the adversaries, the enemies in verse 11, said we will do this by surprise attack and cause the work to cease. And then in verse 12, they receive intelligence from Jews living amidst the people of Samaria, who were not involved in the wall, it would seem, but they were still loyal to their own country. And they sent intelligence 10 times, it says, probably not intended as an exact figure, but a figure of speech, times without number. From all places whence you shall return unto us, they will be upon you. And so, Nehemiah, verse 13, set I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places. Well, it's not clear what that means. It may mean that wherever the wall was half built, there were watchers set. And wherever they had begun to build arches over the gates that were a bit higher up, and battlements beside the gates possibly, they were manned too, naturally. And then he organized people in families, according to their families. Not their children and their wives, but the men, that is. Family groups were armed and put together so that they'd keep up their own morale. And it would remind them of their families who needed their efforts. And then there's the great exhortation, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord and what he's done in the past, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. And that broke the enemy. When they knew there was a strong defence upon these half-constructed walls, they called off the assault. But that didn't mean that the Jews relaxed. It came to pass, verse 16, from that time forth, and there are all the provisions, I won't go through them, whereby the people were organized to watch and defend and work with one hand and hold in the other hand a weapon and so on. And then the people who traveled in, those people from Jericho, for example, and others, they were told, you can't go home, you'll be waylaid on the road and cut down. And we need you here because we've got to keep guard duties going all night. So all the people who go out of the city by day, you stay here at night and lodge here. This is a national emergency. And they did. And also, of course, if people, a great workforce, had been trundling out of the gates every night as though it was a factory gate and going off home and coming back again the next morning, well, all kinds of enemy people could have come in with them. They didn't have weapon detectors in those days. They couldn't stop everybody at the gates. The enemy would get in among them. And so the workers who came from outside were to stay in the city. And the great theme of the second half of this chapter is watchfulness. To watch. They are to pray and they are to watch. So let's make some applications as we move to conclusion. Watchfulness. Well, you know about watchfulness in the church. There hasn't been enough watchfulness in the churches of Jesus Christ as there ought to have been. Look what's happened, I tell you often, in the last 40 years. Look how the world has come into the churches. This is terrible. I read of one notable evangelical name, I won't say who was speaking about a particular pastor who is notorious in North America for cursing, for organizing worldly things. He claims to be a Calvinist as well as solidly evangelical. And yet his behavior is appallingly worldly, and he believes in entering into worldly culture, for the church adopting worldly culture in order to make itself acceptable. And a much sounder man was talking about this other pastor and saying, well, I don't agree with everything he does, but he's a wonderful man. And he's faithful to the gospel. And he's faithful to the scripture, even though I don't agree with everything he does. And I think to myself, where is the discernment of this sounder man? When that individual denies the holiness of God. It's not just that he does some secondary things which are debatable and doubtful. He denies the holiness of God. He says, in effect, God doesn't mind worldly sinful behavior. He doesn't mind it in my life. In fact, he likes it. He doesn't mind it in my church. He doesn't mind that I have the loudest music in Christendom, the most worldly, the most carnal, and my methods are like that, and my language is like that. God doesn't mind. And I believe we should all cultivate this, and then we'll really be on the front line and all the rest of it. Front line? You'll have let the enemy in wholesale, but you've denied a fundamental of the faith, the holiness of God, and the call to his people throughout the Bible to be separate from idolatry, from the world, from ungodliness, from sinfulness. This isn't a secondary matter. I cannot understand how an eminent pastor with a couple of PhDs and all kinds of things actually is so destitute of basic, simple, common sense discernment that he can't see that's a fundamental breach of basic truth. The holiness of God is denied if you reject separation. You have broken the fundamentals of the faith. And we've got to make people more and more aware of this. Because this is the trouble. There hasn't been a watch mounted. People have watched for some things and not others in the church. But what about us in our lives? Let's come to ourselves. Are you always watching? When you miss your prayer time, or it whittles down to a few minutes, does it disturb you? Do you watch your own soul to keep yourself spiritually alive? Does that ring an alarm bell? If you lose heart for witness and you make excuses to yourself as to why you can't or won't, and you accept those excuses and you lose your desire, are you watching? Something's happened to me. I'm seriously out of sorts spiritually. I've lost my desire to count for Jesus Christ. Do you manifest ungracious behavior, snappiness, unkindness, lack of courtesy? Do you notice it? We should, all of us. What's happening to me? I'm drifting away from the Lord. I'm losing my way. Are you becoming self-satisfied? Oh, I'm doing rather well in my life. I've done this, I've done that, Do you watch yourself? Satan has ensnared me. I should not be thinking this way and getting into vanity and conceit and self-satisfaction. Do you find yourself associating with worldly people, worldly friends, getting cold in heart? Old temptations that ruled you before you were converted are coming back little by little. You serving the flesh, watching shows on television, going to the cinema, listening to the wrong kind of music, Going too much to the gym when it becomes not fitness but vanity. Eating too much. Engaging with friends, even good and decent friends, too much to be serving the Lord. Getting involved too much with clothes and fussing and so on. Keep your heart, friends. Watch. We fight and we watch. We watch as churches and we watch as individuals. We watch our hearts and keep them because we want to serve the Lord and please Him and live out our gratitude to Him. That's enough for us this evening. Let's close singing the hymn. It's number